So then that began to bother me, and it turns out that there's an easy way to draw them. You can draw even these two most complicated Platonic, the icosahedron and the dodecahedron. If you just draw, you know, like the dodecahedron, if you just draw the front pentagon face on and then the back pentagon also face on but upside down in dotted lines, and then you just, you know, sort of draw lines out from each of the corners, connect everything up, it turns out to be easy. It's awesome. Anyway, that's Renata's beautiful tetrahedron reminded me of that. Anyway, but please don't spend the whole lecture drawing those.
Too late.
Yeah, that's probably. So a man goes into the psychiatrist's office and he says, "Doctor, you know, my brother, he's crazy. He thinks he's a chicken." And the doctor says, "You know, why don't you turn him in?" And he says, "Well, we would, but we need the eggs." You know? Does anyone recognize where that joke is from? Okay, that joke is from the end of the movie Annie Hall by Woody Allen, which I recommend. But it's not. I had to break with my Russian joke tradition because I think I may be running dry. I think I could be reaching the. If my wife's father were here, he'd be disappointed in me because he certainly told me many more than I've told you. But anyway. Okay, so time is beginning. The end is nigh. You know, the end of the course is beginning to bear down on us, and I'm beginning to worry that I'm not going to get through the stuff that I should get through, which we will. But nevertheless, there's a new anxiety is creeping in. So let's just outline where we're going to go in the final I guess five lectures, and then if I begin to fall behind schedule, you have to really turn the screws. Okay, so today, dark matter. Tomorrow, the matter-antimatter asymmetry. We'll discuss matter-antimatter asymmetry, so baryogenesis. Leptogenesis. And then Thursday, we'll introduce inflation more properly than we have so far. Meet and get to know the homogeneous aspects of inflation. What original problems did it purport to solve? What constraints does it have to satisfy to solve those problems? And then Friday, there's two lectures on Friday, where we will, on the one hand, meet primordial perturbations. What we mean by the primordial density perturbations or the primordial inhomogeneities, deviations from spatial, pure spatial symmetry. How we quantify those, what the basic idea is of how they grow into the structure, that into you and me and the structure that surrounds us in the universe today, and then the inflationary account of these things. We want to derive the basic formula for what the primordial perturbations look like that are generated by inflation. Okay. So let's get down to business. Maybe today will be dark matter, and then a word also about dark energy. So what is the distinction between dark matter and dark energy? One thing I said, you need to basically add these two components that are essentially like perfect fluids. They're essentially two different components of the stress energy tensor that are both both isotropic fluids that are just characterized by a pressure and a density. They have essentially no other character, and the difference is that dark matter appears to observational, to fit the data, we need to have about 25% of the universe in dark matter, and it needs to be, have W equals zero, roughly. So the ratio of its pressure to density is about zero. And the dark energy needs to be roughly 70% of the universe today, and its W needs to be equal to minus one, okay, roughly. Another important distinction. I want to make sure that I cover some material for the tutorial, which is right after this, or this afternoon. So I'm going to kind of maybe invert the order of things slightly relative to what would be pedagogically ideal, just to make sure I get through a couple of calculations. But so I'm going to sort of start by taking you through some of the kind of models or attempts to model dark matter that people have done, some of the theoretical attempts to account for dark matter first, and then with the time remaining at the end, I will hopefully talk a little bit more about what the observational evidence on and observational constraints for dark matter are. But let me just briefly say at the outset that, you know, in addition to this distinction between the equation of state of dark matter and dark energy, you know, the observational evidence for the two, you know, it's in both cases, there's kind of a web of evidence pointing to the two. But one thing to say up front is that the web of evidence pointing to this guy is qualitatively different than the web of evidence pointing to this guy. In both cases, again, we've only so far constrained detected this guy and constrained its properties through its gravitational effect on other things that we do see. And similarly here, we've only constrained its properties through its gravitational effects on other things that we see. So again, as I mentioned last time, something that should be kind of bugging you in the back of your mind is that, you know, are we really correct to be adding, you know, exotic matter components to the universe that are that account for 20 times more than the actual matter in the periodic table that we know and love? Or are these things really telling us that in some way Einstein's theory of general relativity is either incorrect on cosmological scales or we're doing something wrong in interpreting it on cosmological scales? I'll just say in brief at the outset that explanation gets harder and harder. That modifying gravity explanation seems to get harder and harder to get something like that to work as more evidence for dark matter comes in, although it's still a possibility. Here, I would say there's a lot more room for that sort of alternative modifying gravity explanation to work still. But in any case, I'm going to focus on describing to you some of the more popular introduce you to the more popular perspective on attempting to account for these things. There's no really popular. This is we don't have any good explanation for this, but the most discussed, let's say. And here the most popular thing is, for reasons that I'll say a little bit about, is to imagine that it is some sort of gas of massive particles, not particles in the standard model, some particles from some sort of extension of the standard model, and one hopes that non-gravitational evidence for these particles will be found in some way or another, either by seeing them annihilate into gamma rays at the centers of galaxies, or maybe you'll produce these things at the Large Hadron Collider, or maybe you'll directly detect them in a deep underground, very quiet lab. You'll see them bounce off of a nucleus in a giant tank of cleaning fluid. So the experimental distinction between the evidence for this guy and the evidence for this guy is, the evidence for this guy is that it all has the flavor that to account for various observations, we have to change the expansion law. So if the universe just contained matter today, if the universe just contained omega matter, so if it just contained non-relativistic matter today, like we used to think, So some combination of dark matter and, you know, the atoms in the periodic table, baryonic matter. In other words, if the universe consisted of, was dominated today by matter with W equals zero, then the homogeneous Friedman-Robertson-Walker character of the universe would be off relative to observations. Okay, so in other words, one way to say this is that if you count up all the matter that we can find in the universe today, all of the non-relativistic matter, it appears to add up to, various measurements indicate that it adds up to about 30%, 25% dark matter, 5%. So 30% of the critical density, in other words. It adds up to only 30% of the critical density. And so we said from looking at the Friedman equations, that would, if that was all there was, that would indicate a universe that was open, quite detectably different from spatially flat. It would be spatially open with negative curvature, k equals minus 1. And so, in fact, what we see most precisely from the cosmic microwave background is that the universe actually appears to be flat with k equals 0 to the best that we can detect. So in other words, we find that instead of rho matter, instead of the total energy density in the universe being only 30% of the critical density today, that geometrical tests indicate that rho total today is about equal to the critical density, plus or minus 1%. So we end up, by that sort of argument, having to add 70% of something else to make up the difference. And then on the other hand, there are other tests that have to do with how the scale factor varies with time. So if the universe was if the universe had been dominated by matter since early times, if there was no dark energy, then for a long time, for billions of years, the scale factor would have been very well modeled by, if you solve the Friedman equations with matter in them, it goes like a power of t to the 2/3. It goes like this particular power of t. And in such a universe, you can, there are various ways to test whether the scale factor really is doing this, really has been doing this as a function of time for the past several billion years. In various ways, you see that it does not appear to be doing this. Instead, it appears to be better described as that A of t is what you would get if you did this. If you took instead of just taking pure dark matter, which would lead to this function of time, you took 30% dark matter, 70% dark energy today, had them scale in their respective ways. So you took rho matter today to be 30% of the critical density and to scale with time as a over a naught to the minus 3 like matter normally does. And then you added some dark energy, rho dark energy, which is 70% of the critical density today and then scales with time like a W equals 0 fluid does. You put that on the right-hand side of the Friedman equation. The left-hand side is h, which is a dot over a squared. This is an equation that you can integrate to get a as a function of time. And that scale factor as a function of time appears to better fit data. Okay, so in other words, both these sorts of evidence, the CMB constraints on the geometry, the curvature of the spatial geometry, and these various tests of how a scales with time, these are saying that you need dark energy to make the homogeneous background, the symmetric zeroth order unperturbed cosmological background evolve in a way that is consistent with observations. In other words, the evidence for dark energy really does not have, there's no evidence, we have no evidence for that dark energy clumps, we have no evidence that there are galaxies made of dark energy out there or that dark energy has fallen into our own galaxy in the way that we do have evidence that dark matter has fallen into galaxies, for example, or fallen into clusters of galaxies, or I should say the other way around, really, that dark matter clumped and then clusters of galaxies fell in where dark matter clumped. So that foreshadows what I was going to say. With dark matter, it's roughly speaking the opposite. Most of the evidence for dark matter has the opposite character. It's not so much that we need it to change the spatial geometry of the universe, or that we need it to change the evolution of the scale factor as a function of time, although to some degree there is that sort of evidence for it. But most of the evidence has to do with when you see clumped structures where little inhomogeneities have grown into collapsed objects like galaxies or clusters of galaxies. There you need dark matter. Yeah.
Isn't that true that we can make any kind of functions for H using those kind of powers and those kind of rules and then adding some other terms? And I mean, well, whatever happens, we can describe it using such a model, right?
Yeah, that's true. So you mean if I allowed myself to just add any old matter component with any values of W here on the right hand side? That's right. So the statement is that this model where you add two components, you have to add four parameters here. The density of dark matter today, the density of dark energy today, and then the W associated with this, and the W associated with this. And then the W associated with this, you don't really have to add, because the W you're putting in here is the W that you would get from a cosmological constant, which it's always been a puzzle why the cosmological constant wasn't there in the data. So in a way, it's a term that's predicted to be there. Its size, its value today, is absurdly small relative to what is predicted, but the existence of this term and its value for W equals minus 1, in other words, some non-zero vacuum energy, is the thing you generically expect. So in a way, you've added three, you've been forced to add three parameters to the data. But in that way, you account for many more than three observations. So it is the most economical, currently known extension of the standard cosmology that accounts for all the data. But that's right. You can always add more and more parameters and maybe account for the, you know, well, that's the thing. At the moment there is no clear evidence that there's any further parameter that you could add to the model that I described yesterday that would significantly improve the collective fit to cosmological data enough to justify its inclusion. So the evidence for dark matter is more like, well, for example, the way it was discovered was Fritz Zwicky back in the 1930s observed galaxies. There are these things called clusters of galaxies, which you see on the sky. There are certain patches of the sky where there's just tons of galaxies, 1,000 galaxies clustered right in one little spot on the sky. And those galaxies are bound to one another and are orbiting around. And so it's like a gas with 1,000 particles, basically, 1,000 galaxies floating around in it. And each of those galaxies, well, you can see how much light the galaxies are emitting. And that light is basically coming from stars. And, you know, we basically know how stars work. So if you know that how much light is being emitted in the spectrum of that light, you can figure out what is the total mass in stars in those galaxies. And you can ask, you know, given how much mass in stars there are, does the gravity due to all that stellar mass account for how fast these things are whirling around each other, right? The more gravitational force between them, the faster they will want to whirl around one another. And the answer was no, that you appear to need at least 10 times as much mass as the observed mass in stars in these galaxies to explain how fast they're whirling around one another. And then later in the 70s, Vera Rubin did it's kind of a similar thing, but on a smaller scale. If you look at individual galaxies, and you plot how fast the stars are orbiting around the galaxy as a function of the radius away. So this is radius from the center of the galaxy, and this is how fast the stars are orbiting. Okay, so you get some curve. Well, again, you can predict. If the light that you see coming from stars was all the mass that was in those galaxies, if the stars that are emitting the light that you see were all the mass that was binding the galaxy together, you could predict what the rotation velocity of those stars would be as a function of radius in response to their own gravitational pull, in response to the gravitational pull of all the other stars. And you know what you predict is something roughly like, well, initially the curve rises as the star is orbiting more and more other stars that are pulling it inward, but eventually you get out to some point where, roughly speaking, you see the stars trail off. There's no more light coming from the galaxy. So that's basically where the mass concentration ends. And then there's some straggler stars that are further out, and you predict to see that the velocities get lower and lower as you know, if you take a fixed mass like the sun and put a planet further and further out, the rotational velocity, the circular rotational velocity, goes down, and you expect to see a similar thing when you get further and further away from this radius where the bulk of the mass of the galaxy ends. And instead, you see again and again in many galaxies that as far out as you can see, much further than this predicted hump, that the rotation curve becomes flat, and the galaxies appear to have, I mean, the stars appear to have constant rotation velocity as a function of radius. Or another example of a clumping measurement is another sort of measurement that people do is general relativity predicts that if you have a mass like the sun and a star behind it, and then you're the observer over here, that there's gravitational lensing, that you'll see that the light ray will coming to you will be bent a little bit as it passes the star. And you can observe, so the star acts like a lens. The intervening mass here acts like a lens that refracts the rays coming from background sources. And so in particular, in massive clusters of galaxies, again, in a cluster of galaxy like this, if you look at it, what you'll see is, you'll see a bunch of galaxies that are together at the same redshift. They're the real galaxies in the cluster. But then you'll also see background galaxies that just happen to lie far behind the cluster but in the same direction on the sky. So you can see that they're way behind the cluster because they have some different redshift. You can measure how much their spectral lines, their emitted atomic lines, are redshifted. So they're coming from a much different distance. And some of those will appear, you know, stretched out into these crazy banana shapes, and you'll actually see multiple copies of the same. You can see, you know, in various cases, you can see multiple copies of the same galaxy, because it's been split by the lens into several different images, each of which is very distorted. Just like, you know, if you had a very lumpy optical lens, you would see similar effects. Okay, so again, you can ask, you know, what mass needs to be present here according to general relativity to do all of this, all of the lensing that's observed. And again, you need something that is at least a factor of 10 larger than the observed mass in stars, or in fact, that's quite a bit larger than. It turns out these clusters also have other mass that is in the form of hot gas, hot gas just, you know, sort of diffusely floating through the cluster. But still, it's the mass that you need to do the lensing is a lot more than that. Anyway, so various observations like this all point to a consistent picture of how much dark matter you need. They all seem to point to the need for dark matter. Anyway, at the outset, maybe that's all I will say by way of observational motivation. Just that if you're thinking about possible explanations for these two things or possible alternatives to the usual explanations, you know, the most important thing to keep in mind is that the evidence for this guy is qualitatively different than the evidence for this guy, in the sense I described. And frankly, the evidence for this is significantly stronger, although they both really have gotten stronger over the past decade or so.
Question. I don't understand how can we use the bending of light to measure the distance?
Yeah, well, so if you have a... to measure the distance, the thing that you measure is how much mass is in here, and the idea is that so in fact they do very detailed modeling of these things, but the rough idea is just that what you can work out in general relativity is that if you have a point mass and an object a certain distance behind that point mass, that there's Let's say you have a point mass, and then directly, perfectly aligned behind the source, there's another point mass that's emitting light. There's a star behind it that's emitting light. Then there is the light rays from that star come around, you know, they go around the star in all directions, and what you see on the sky is a ring, a light ring. And so that given the mass and the distance of the source behind the star, there is this characteristic ring around the source, which is related to something called the Einstein ring. And basically, these most highly bent images, this Einstein ring is where you see images most highly bent. For example, in this case where the source is perfectly aligned behind the source, when the source is perfectly aligned behind the lens, behind the mass, you see it extremely bent. It gets changed from a point into a ring. So these extremely distorted sources are lying very near the Einstein ring, corresponding to those sources. And so they're telling you where the Einstein ring is on the sky around that cluster. And that is telling you about the mass of the cluster. That depends on the mass. That depends on the mass of the thing that's doing the lensing. So roughly speaking, by seeing where the highly distorted lenses are and
like
seeing how distant they are relative to
like the intensity of the ring or just the radius of the ring?
The main thing is just how far what is the distance of the various images away from the middle of the cluster. That's like the most important handle. Now, I mean, okay. See, you can feel I'm like rushing a little bit more.
What's the reason that, like you said, it's dark matter is not baryonic? Is that like why can't it just be like normal baryon dust, not in stars, but just in space?
Okay. Yeah. So there is. Will you permit me to put that off until the end of the lecture? There's actually okay. Let me say a few words about it now. Yes, you're right to not permit me. Okay. So there's various ways. There's various arguments. One has to do with Big Bang nucleosynthesis. So in Big Bang nucleosynthesis, the cosmological abundances of the lightest elements in the periodic table were determined in the first few seconds after the Big Bang, when things were cooling down and various nuclear reactions were freezing out. Turns out that by fitting that, you have a free parameter in that process in the early universe, which is precisely the eta, the ratio of the number of photons to the number of baryons. And as you vary that parameter eta, okay, you don't change the helium abundance very much. That's the thing I explained the other day was that Big Bang nucleosynthesis does a good job of getting the helium abundance correct to be about 25%. But you do, it is, but the other abundances, some of them are quite sensitive to eta, and so in particular the deuterium abundance, the heavy hydrogen abundance, is sensitive to eta. And from that you get a measurement of eta. You get a measurement by fitting the theory to the observed nuclear abundances. That gives you a measurement of eta, the number of photons to baryons today. And that's one way to find out that the baryon fraction today, you know, we know the number of photons today. That's the number of photons in the CMB, whose temperature we have measured. So if you combine that with this measurement of eta, that tells you the number of baryons today, and that corresponds to this 5% of the critical density today. It does not fit if you take this ratio, so that this is the full 30% of the you know density today that would account for baryons plus dark matter. So then it turns out that in the cosmic microwave background, remember how I described the cosmic microwave background was I drew this plot. You observe these oscillations in the power spectrum of the cosmic microwave background. And I drew this plot of, as a function of scale factor, as the universe expands, the radiation is dropping as a to the minus 4, and then there's matter dropping as a to the minus 3, and then dark energy. And we said that it's kind of the CMB oscillations take place in this window between when the moment of matter radiation equality and the moment when all of the hydrogen, all of the protons and electrons want to combine into neutral hydrogen atoms. And it's key. So up until this moment, baryonic matter is being buffeted by photons. It can't collapse into, it can't undergo gravitational instability. Instead, what it does is, if there's a pit in the gravitational potential, again, the story was that the baryonic matter, the atoms, the hydrogen atoms, want to fall in, but then they're coupled to these hot photons, and the pressure of those photons builds up and wants to push them back out, and they oscillate. And you observe these oscillations in the CMB. But it's key, in order to get those oscillations correct, that they have big potential wells to fall into. And how big do those potential wells have to be? Well, they have to be exactly as big as they would be if 1/6 of the matter was actually dark matter that was not being pushed around by the photons but was freely allowed to clump into these wells. So you get another measurement of eta, a totally independent measurement of eta from the CMB, which turns out to be very nicely consistent with this same value. So again, it's telling you that only 5% of the baryons can be. And then the other thing to say is just that people do experiments to look, to directly detect. If there was something like a proton, protons or neutrons floating around in our galaxy or in our solar system with the abundance that dark matter is supposed to have, there are these underground detectors that would be able to detect those. So they've tried to directly detect, let's say it was neutrons. Neutrons are not stable, so it can't be neutrons. But that's the thing. It can't really be anything. It doesn't work. Yeah.
Neutrinos?
Okay, so we'll get to neutrinos. Okay, that's good. I'm going to take that as a invitation to go on to the next there's just two calculations that I want to have you guys go over in tutorial, so I want to at least sketch them on the board first to make life go more smoothly. Oops. Yeah. Yes, unfortunately this has a little bit of a kind of lightning introduction feel. I was trying to be in the first when introducing the basic picture trying to be kind of leisurely and let it all sink in. And I know this is going. I know there's just no way around it. This part, unfortunately, I have to kind of zoom through a little bit faster. But at least it'll give you an introduction to some of the basic ideas, some of the basic attempted explanations. I hope you won't be too upset if it doesn't if it's not as thorough. Okay, so again the order in which I want to present things is that, well, historically there have been two sort of attempted explanations for dark matter. They kind of can be classified in two categories. They're machos. In other words, maybe machos are massive compact halo objects. So this is, you know, the idea that maybe it's just a bunch of big things, but just that happen to be dark, like big black holes or little black holes or who knows what, but, you know, not microscopic things, but big macroscopic objects, maybe black holes, that are just floating around and that are hard to detect directly because they don't have any matter around them shining. Okay, so I'm just going to say about these that although this possibility is not strictly ruled out, there are some windows and ways to try to make it work. In every way that it has been tested, a huge amount of the phase space, whatever is amenable to test, has been ruled out. So these guys, possible, but you have to, at this point, kind of thread the eye of a needle, and it doesn't look very likely for machos. So I'm going to set machos aside. It's probably not this. The other possibility are WIMPs. These are so-called weakly interacting massive particles. In other words, this is the idea that what we're dealing with dark matter is another particle like the zoo of particles in the Standard Model, except that it happens. So it's a massive, but microscopic, you know, elementary, basically, particle that just happens to not interact with standard model particles or interact sufficiently weakly with standard model particles that we have not yet been able to see it bump into one of the particles in our detectors or emit a standard model particle that we've been able to detect. Okay, and now here, okay, so if you have a massive particle, you know, it had to have fallen out of equilibrium at some point. You know, if it stayed in equilibrium and it was massive, we saw that when the temperature dropped below its mass, it became exponentially rare. So if you have a massive particle hanging around today with some reasonable abundance, at some point in the early universe, it had to go out of equilibrium. And so we can divide it into two categories, depending on whether it ever was in equilibrium. If it ever was in equilibrium, if it was first in equilibrium in the early universe with the rest of the expanding thermal plasma, and then fell out, and then at some point decoupled, that's called a thermal relic. And then there's a second category where it just never was in equilibrium. It was just always out of equilibrium with the thermal plasma. So that's called a non-thermal relic. Okay, and then it's useful to divide the thermal relics into two qualitatively different categories. The so-called hot thermal relics, so these are particles that fell out of equilibrium when they were still relativistic, decoupled from the thermal plasma when they were relativistic, and then cold thermal relics. Are the opposite. They were originally in equilibrium, but they fell out of equilibrium when they were already non-relativistic. Okay, and so associated with each of these, there's a sort of standard candidate. Hot thermal relics, well, first of all, we'll see that the dark matter cannot be a hot thermal relic. On the other hand, there is a hot thermal relic in the standard model. And this argument that rules out this as a dark matter candidate was one of the original and best, you know, continues to be one of the best limits on its mass. So the neutrino, the light neutrinos in the standard model, are hot thermal relics. And we'll see that the argument that rules out dark matter also gives a nice bound on their mass. Cold thermal relics, this is the one, almost everything we know about dark matter is negative information. We know what it's not. Here in cold thermal relics, this is the most popular candidate at the moment. And that is because of something, a calculation that I'll try to sketch quickly for you called the WIMP miracle, where something, you do a calculation of what its abundance should be today and something actually works out nicely. Something, nature gives you a little pat on the back and says, you know, that calculation looks like it turned out like maybe this idea is on the right track. The standard candidate, the sort of canonical example of a cold thermal relic, would be the lightest supersymmetric particle. Okay, in a supersymmetric extension of the standard model. And then here, there is a standard non-thermal candidate for a non-thermal relic that's called the axion. Okay, so let's just start. This calculation is quick, and I'd just like to show this is a little bit messier than what we've previously done in previous lectures, in the sense that, you know, it's like it's quite elementary algebra, but there's like plugging in numbers and stuff, and it's just gross. But you have to think, you know, you have to get in the Gamov spirit. You know, you have to meditate. I should have had you meditate before the lecture and just sort of repeat as your mantra, you know, Gamov, Gamov. But you have to get in that spirit. You know, if you want to win a Nobel Prize for discovering something in cosmology, you are likely going to have to do a calculation like this along the way. If you have an extension of the standard model and you want to see if it's you have a proposed way that the standard model is extended, it's very likely that the first evidence from that will come from cosmology, not from laboratory tests, or it's quite possible. And to do that, to see if your model is consistent at all with what we know about cosmology, you'll have to go through a calculation like this. Usually a calculation like this will allow you to rule out your model without having to spend too much time on it. So you know, it's fast, but it's a little ugly, but just bear with me. The idea is once you get used to this sort of calculation, it's gross, but you can do it in 15 minutes and then you're done. You can move on with your life, go to the next model that actually works. Okay. So suppose that there is some additional particle in the early universe that decouples from the thermal plasma when it was still relativistic. Okay, it was in thermal equilibrium at early times, but then at some point, it's the reactions that kept it in thermal equilibrium couldn't keep up with the expansion rate. Okay, so the reaction rates at some point, at the moment of quote-unquote freeze-out or decoupling, became equal to and then fell below the expansion rate. And after that, it decoupled and was just a stable particle that just hung around and expanded with the rest of the universe. So what are the constraints on such a thing? Well, so here's a standard trick. So after the moment that it freezes out, let's imagine there's some moment where it freezes out when this condition is satisfied. After that moment, if it's a stable particle, like the light neutrino, total number is conserved. So its physical number density has to scale like the number density of a conserved quantity. It has to scale as, like we've seen again and again, it has to scale like a to the minus 3. And if, okay, let's assume that since this moment of decoupling, that the universe has expanded adiabatically. It appears to be the case that at least since Big Bang nucleosynthesis, very dramatic things have to happen for a significant amount of entropy to be generated. So, for most of cosmic history, it is the case that the expansion rate, which is sort of cosmological, is much slower than the microphysical particle reaction rates, which are can be very high. And under those circumstances, the expansion is quasi adiabatic. And the entropy is conserved. Okay, so the entropy also falls like a to the minus 3. So the idea is that if both things behaved this way ever since freeze out, then this ratio at freeze out, the ratio of the density of this relic particle chi at the moment of freeze out over the entropy density at the moment of freeze out is equal to the ratio today. The number density of chi particles today over the entropy density today. Okay, so let's solve this equation for the number density today. And then we just plug in. Well, we know all three factors on this side. So n sub chi f, the number density when it froze out because it was relativistic. Well, for a single species, we saw in a previous lecture, and you're checking on the homework, that it's this for a single species, and then if the chi particle has a number of internal degrees of freedom, let's say it has two spin states or something like that, we have to multiply this by a factor that accounts for each spin state. So if it has two spin states, this is g is 2, for example. Or if it has two spin states and it comes in both antiparticle and particle variety, then this is 4. Okay? And then the entropy density, again, we have an expression for that. Per species, per relativistic species, it's 2 pi squared over 45 t cubed. And so at freeze-out, it was t at freeze-out cubed times the number of relativistic species at freeze-out. So that's, and similarly today, it's the same expression, but with the temperature of the relativistic bath today, in other words, the CMB temperature, and the number of relativistic species today, okay, which happens to be a known number that I'm not going to drive for you, but it's 3.91. That's basically, I won't explain why it's exactly 3.91, but that's basically, there's two polarizations of photons, and then there's plus neutrinos. So if it had just been photons, it would be 2. turns out that because of a detail that I don't want to get into that isn't really important for this calculation, if you add the neutrinos, instead of adding an integer like you might expect, you add this non-integer value. Don't worry about it. So if you plug these expressions in, what happens? Well, if we collect the g's first, we get g sub chi, the number of relativistic species today over the number of relativistic species it frees out. This 2 pi over 45 cancels that one. We get this factor, zeta of 3 over pi squared. There's a TF cubed in the numerator, a TF cubed in the denominator that cancel. There's this T0 cubed in the numerator. OK, so that's the predicted number density of these particles today. And now what we want to check is what is their energy density today? If their energy density is bigger than the critical density, that's bad, because we know that the dark matter, we know that there are no massive particles with energy larger than the critical density. In fact, if it's any bigger than the measured dark matter abundance, which is about 25% of the critical density, then that's bad. So so the energy density today, well, it's non-relativistic today. Or at worst, it's non-relativistic today. So its energy density today is its mass times its number density, like the formula we derive for a non-relativistic species. So in other words, the energy density in chi today over the critical density today is, this is the energy density in chi today, where n sub chi today is given by this formula. And the critical density today is, well, remember the critical density at any time is 3h squared over 8 pi g newton. And then let me write, it's convenient to write g newton again as in units where h bar is c is 1, g newton is 1 over m Planck squared. So let me write that, well, let me write this as 3h squared times the Planck mass squared over 8 pi. Okay. Okay. So if we just plug in this expression, now we have a bunch of known quantities here. I'm not gonna plug in all the numbers now. But you know the temperature of the CMB today, that's a known number. This is some number like 1.2. This is all known. Again, this is 3.91. These two guys are unknown. This is known. This is known. So this is not known. So if we keep just the unknown quantities and plug in the rest of the numbers, which I won't do on the board, but the result is, so just taking this formula, plugging in numbers everywhere we can, is g sub chi over gs sub f times basically 0.1 times the mass of the chi particle over 1 eV. Okay? So in other words, okay, g sub chi, we don't know, but you know, maybe the relic has, if it's a spin 1/2 particle, then g sub chi might be 2, or if it's a spin 1 particle, g sub chi might be 3, or if you include antiparticles, it might be 6. But anyway, this is a number of order unity for any particle we've ever encountered, for any type of particle we've ever encountered. And then the total number of relativistic degrees of freedom, well, again, that could be big. For example, if you take all of the particles in the standard model, if you look at very early times when the temperature was very high above the electroweak phase transition so that all of the particles in the standard model were relativistic, even then, G is only about 100 for the standard model. And at later times, it would have been significantly lower than that, maybe more like 10. So anyway, this number is something like 1 over 10, maybe 1 over 100. Whereas the whole thing, again, can't be more than about 25. The whole thing can't be more than about 0.25, the 25% of the critical density that dark matter accounts for today. So all in all, this is saying that, this is telling you that the mass of the relic particle had better be less than about 1 eV times this fudge factor that we don't quite know. So GS it frees out over G chi. So maybe it's roughly, for the neutrino, this is saying, the neutrino again is an example of a particle that did freeze out this way. So this is giving you a bound in the neutrino mass where at the time that it froze out, GS was of order 10, and G sub chi is of order a few. So this is telling you that the mass of the neutrino has to be less than, or the sum of the masses of the light neutrinos has to be less than about 10 eV. So that was quite an early and very strong bound on the mass of the neutrino. More generally, it's telling you that a massive particle that freezes out when it was still hot has to have a mass less than, 10 or maybe 100 eV. And so that turns out to rule it out as dark matter, because a particle that light, remember that what we learned about a particle that light will free stream across the universe. It will stream across the universe as if it's relativistic, but its momentum will redshift as 1 over a. So basically what happens is the amount of, so if we draw, okay, just for visualization purposes, if we imagine the spatial sections of the universe are a sphere, so this whole sphere is expanding, even though actually the universe is flat, but it's just kind of easier to visualize that it's a sphere. What a massive particle does is if it's not a co-moving observer, if it initially has some spatial momentum, it zooms across the universe. While it's relativistic, it basically zooms across the universe like it's a photon. But then, at some point here, as its momentum is dropping, its velocity ceases to be relativistic. Its velocity becomes non-relativistic. And at that point, roughly speaking, that's about as far as it goes. It quickly comes to rest after that point. Okay, so what is the problem with that? The problem is that if you, a particle that's very light, a particle whose mass is 10 eV, only 10 eV, that's very light by particle physics standards, that became non-relativistic when the temperature of the universe, only when the temperature of the universe had dropped to, let's say, 1 eV or 10 eV. So that's sufficiently late that, this is harder to explain succinctly than I imagined it was going to be. So the idea is the following. What we want in the early universe is that if we take the density perturbations, the tiny fluctuations in the density from point to point in space, they start off very small, and then gravitational instability makes them grow with time. So this region has a little bit more density, so it has a little bit more gravity. This region has a little bit less density, so it has a little bit less gravity. So matter gets pulled out of this trough and towards this peak, and so the peak grows, the trough also grows, and you end up, if you follow it quantitatively, you end up getting sort of, the matter ends up getting clustered over here and eventually turns into a galaxy or whatever, some structure in the late universe. So that relies on the idea that gravity is the dominant thing, that this gravitational instability is the thing that wins. Okay, but in the room here, that's not what happens. If you have a little overdensity in that corner of the room and a underdensity in this corner of the room, the matter does not fly over to that corner of the room to be with the slight overdensity. Instead, the pressure of the room is sufficient. The random velocities of the atoms in the room are sufficient that the thing that wins is the desire of their entropic desire to spread out uniformly in the room. So if a particle is so light, is so relativistic, that before it becomes non-relativistic, it can stream across length scales that are longer than the distance between this peak and this trough, then that tendency will win. The entropic tendency for this density perturbation to just smooth itself out as all the particles stream every which way will win over gravitational instability. And so what happens is that if a dark matter particle is too light, it stays relativistic until too late, and it manages to wipe out longer and longer wavelengths until it wipes out such long wavelengths that it's in conflict with observation, because we observe that density, that structure in the universe has grown into very big structures today on those wavelengths, on those length scales. Okay, so that was much less clear than I had imagined it would be in my mind. But give me a chance to sleep on that and come back and give a more palatable explanation of that. But okay. So to make a long story short, we've at least seen how you calculate if something fell out of equilibrium when it was relativistic and came to today, how you calculate its abundance today. And the basic idea is important to get across, that we found out that it's so light that in order to not account for more than the dark matter density, it has to be so light that it can't be the dark matter. Because if all of the dark matter was this particle, then instead of helping out with gravitational instability, which is where all the evidence for dark matter comes from, helping to grow structures and give them extra gravity, clumps and give them extra gravity, it would do the opposite. It would be zooming across the universe so fast that it would wipe out a lot of the structures that we see before they ever had a chance to grow. Okay. Okay. Now I'm just going to sketch. I'm just going to give an abbreviated sketch of the calculation of the WIMP miracle, which is, again, the idea in the tutorial this afternoon is to go through on your own these two calculations. But I just want to say 5 minutes about this to make it easier to go through on your own. OK, so what would happen if we instead imagined that a particle in the early universe dropped out of thermal equilibrium when it was already non-relativistic? Well, let's first ask, At what point will it freeze out? Okay, so it'll freeze out when the reaction rate that's keeping it in equilibrium is equal to the expansion rate. Okay, at the moment of freeze out, that equation will be true. So the idea with a cold thermal relic is that you have that these particles can annihilate, can bump into one another and annihilate into, so let's say it's a chi particle and an antiparticle, they can annihilate into some standard model particles, like let's say two photons or a neutrino and an antineutrino or something like that. Okay, so suppose this chi particle has some cross-section sigma for annihilating with this anti-chi particle. Then what will be the rate for this reaction? Well, if this chi particle is moving at velocity v and with cross-section sigma, well, that cross-section sigma, you can think of that as a little disk that the particle carries along with it. And when it moves for a time t, it's that disk sweeps out a distance vt, and so a volume sigma times v times t. And when that volume that it sweeps out, sigma times v times the time, gets big enough that it encloses, on average, one other dark matter particle, we'll have a scattering event, okay? So the condition for having a scattering event is that this volume times the number density of chi particles is equal to unity. This is a way to estimate how much time has to go by before this cross-section has swept out enough volume to contain, on average, one other chi particle. But 1 over that time is the rate for this reaction. So this says that the rate for the annihilation process is the cross-section for the annihilation process times the typical velocity times the number density of chi particles. The typical velocity, since we're non-relativistic, can be estimated as, well, the temperature right before it freezes out is roughly the thermal energy of the chi particle. So that's something like its kinetic energy when it's non-relativistic. So solving this for V, we have that V is of order the square root of T over M. Okay, so this is sigma times the square root of T. So at freeze out, this is sigma at freeze out, the velocity of freeze out, and N sub chi at freeze out. So sigma at freeze out, TF over M sub chi. The number density at freeze out, well, it's non-relativistic and was just in thermal equilibrium, so we know we derived the expression for that. It's our old friend, the non-relativistic number density expression. Okay, and times the number of relativistic degrees of freedom. Okay, so that's one side of the expression. The other side of the expression is H at freeze out. And from the Friedman equation, so the Friedman equation says H squared is equal to 8 pi G over 3, or in other words, 8 pi over 3 M Planck squared times rho, and then rho, the total energy density in the universe, is this is sometime in the early universe, the radiation-dominated universe. This is the expression for the energy density in the radiation bath. So that's this other expression we derive, and you derive in the homework, pi squared over 30 times the temperature to the fourth times the number of relativistic degrees of freedom. In other words, I'm saying this is this. So H is the square root of this thing. So H is 8 pi over 3 M Planck squared, pi squared over 30 times the total number of relativistic degrees of freedom at the moment of freeze out times the temperature at the moment of freeze out. Okay, now the point here is that, well, first of all, T cancels on both sides. So there's T to the fourth square root, so there's T squared here, and here there's T to the 3/2 times the square root of T. So T squared cancels on both sides. So the only place where T appears is inside the exponential. And this is really the thing we want to solve for. We want to find out, this is the first step in this calculation, is we want to figure out at what temperature did the freeze-out process occur? Because that's important. That's gonna, the whole result is gonna depend, you know, in principle, exponentially on that. Okay, so we just defined, it's convenient to define M sub chi over T sub F as X sub F. So if X sub F is 20, that's saying that the temperature fell 20 times below the mass before freeze-out occurred. So if we just solve for that quantity, if we solve for X sub F in this equation, we get log of G sub chi over G sub F, the total number of, so the spin degrees of freedom of the chi particle divided by the square root of the number of degrees of freedom, number of relativistic particles at freeze out. And then Okay. So now, finally, we can, now finally that we have that bit of information, we can just do the same trick that we did before. Which again, this is a trick that you use again and again. This is like maybe one of the key takeaway tools about doing early universe cosmologies. You have some relic that after the moment where it decoupled, its number was conserved, and so its number density fell as 8^-3, and so you just, the starting point for any calculation is this fact that once that's true, the ratio of its number density over S is conserved. They both fall as 8^-3. So the ratio at the moment of freeze out is the same as their ratio today. So again, we solve this to find the number density today. And so again, this is 2 pi squared over 45 times the temperature today, 2 pi squared over 45 times the temperature at freeze out. Okay, the 2 pi squareds over 45 cancel. And then there's the number of relativistic degrees of freedom today and at freeze out. And then our non-relativistic number density expression for this guy at freeze out. So the number of chi particles times okay. So now notice, so this is really exponential of minus what we called x sub f, the thing that we solved for here. So let me rewrite this guy as exponential of minus x sub f. And I can just take this expression, plug it in there. So in other words, I replace this guy by 1 over this argument. Meanwhile, here, I had t sub f to the 3/2 divided by t sub f cubed. So I can bring this inside and get m sub chi over t sub f to the 3/2. So in other words, x sub f to the 3/2. So this whole thing becomes, so this plus this just becomes x sub f over 2 pi to the 3/2. And then I have these extra factors hanging around. So I have a expression for this. To get the expression for the energy density of the chi particles today, that's just the mass of the chi particle times its number density today. And I divide that again by rho critical today, which is, again, just 3 times the Hubble rate today times m Planck squared over 8 pi. So anyway, I just plug all of that in. It's just an elementary exercise in algebra to plug all that stuff in and find that at the end of the day, you get that the energy density in chi particles today divided by the critical density is equal to 10^-10 GeV squared times the annihilation cross section, sigma sub f, the cross section for this reaction, times x sub f to the 3/2 G sub f to the 1/2 and so now what is the point of this expression? So x sub f depends is a logarithm of the unknown quantities. So I can change the unknown quantities by a huge amount inside the logarithm and not change the value of x sub f. So this factor here you can don't concentrate on. This is a very unimportant factor. It's roughly of order unity. This equation is basically saying that in order to get the right abundance today. In order to get this ratio to be order unity, or 0.25, that will work regardless of the mass of the chi particle as long as you get this factor here to be of order unity. So in other words, as long as you get sigma sub f, the annihilation cross-section, to be about 10 to the minus 10 times 1 over g v squared. And the thing that I would like you to convince yourself in the tutorial is if you estimate, well, crap. If you estimate, let's say that the annihilation cross section was by some diagram like this, where a chi and a chi bar come in, they annihilate to a Z boson, and then they go, I don't know, to two neutrinos. Then, in other words, if the annihilation is mediated by a boson just like the weak, just basically the same mass as the weak bosons, so let's say the mass of the Z boson, and the chi particles themselves, in other words, the stable dark particle is just the same mass as one of the typical stable heavy particles in our universe, the proton. So if you take the nucleon mass for these guys, the Z boson mass here, and a coupling constant of order the weak coupling constant, then this is exactly the natural cross section that you would estimate. It would automatically have this value. Okay, so if the dark matter was a particle that had about the same mass as the proton, and it weakly interacted, so it was carried by particles, either the same particles, the same weak bosons that carry the weak force in the standard model, or particles similar to those that basically have the same mass and coupling strength as those, you would get the cross-section to turn out correct to predict that particle would have the right abundance today to be the dark matter. Okay, so that as I say, it's a little bit of a mess, but it's worth going through once on your own. It's the one kind of positive pat on the back we have about the actual particle nature of dark matter, that in a way this calculation suggests that if you plug in the most natural numbers you might think of, that you get the right predicted dark matter abundance out. Okay, apologies for running over.